It is Friday, June the 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, President Trump decides whether the U.S. remains part of the Paris Climate Accords.
So we're getting out, but we will start to negotiate, and we will see if we can make a deal that's fair.
Also ahead, a U.S. missile defense test.
This was an historic test, the first time we actually tested and intercepted an ICBM missile with the same trajectory, the same distance, the same capability as the current North Korea capability.
Coming up, helping feed Africa's hungry, plus tackling hate speech online. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. As promised, President Trump made a decision about whether the U.S. should remain part of the climate change accords written in Paris. He spoke Thursday in the Rose Garden at the White House.
I am fighting every day for the great people of this country. Therefore, in order to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens, the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord Thank you. Thank you. But begin negotiations to re-enter either the Paris Accord or in really entirely new transaction on terms that are fair to the United States, its businesses, its workers, its people, its taxpayers. So we're getting out, but we will start to negotiate and we will see if we can make a deal that's fair. And if we can, that's great. And if we can't, that's fine.
Reaction to the decision by Mr. Trump has been global. In Paris, President Emmanuel Macron spoke on national television.
Now, let me say a few words to our American friends. Climate change is one of the major issues of our time. It is already changing our daily lives, but it is global. Everyone is impacted. And if we do nothing, our children will know a world of migrations, of wars, of shortage, a dangerous world. It is not the future we want for ourselves. It is not the future we want for our children. It is not the future we want for our world. Today, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, announced his decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Agreement. I do respect this decision, but I do think it is an actual mistake, both for the U.S. and for our planet. I just said, President Trump, in a few words, a few minutes ago, this assessment. Tonight, I wish to tell the United States, France believes in you. The world believes in you. I know that you are a great nation. I know your history, our common history. To all scientists, engineers, entrepreneurs, responsible citizens who were disappointed by the decision of the President of the United States, I want to say that they will find in France a second homeland. I call on them, come and work here with us to work together on concrete solutions for our climate, our environment. I can assure you, France will not give up the fight.
International Edition's Lori London speaks with the former head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Christine Todd Whitman, about President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords.
From the president's perspective, what he has said is that it will cost us jobs, that he's putting America first. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the statistics that he used were just wrong. In fact, I think we're going to see an impact, a negative impact on jobs by this, because trade sanctions work both ways. And when you have every other major industrialized country and every other really country, other than we're now in bed with Syria and with North Korea, Nicaragua, I'm not sure the company we want to keep. First of all, they're not going to renegotiate. This has taken a long time to get there. A lot of what he said was mandatory is not mandatory, and they're not about to sit down at the table to renegotiate this. They have already doubled down, and China has already reached out to the European Union saying, We want to continue this. We want to make sure this is real. We have left now a gap in leadership that is going to be filled by others. And I think that what you'll see, too, is some of the nations that are part of this and are going to stay there are going to say, you know what? You like trade wars? We're going to put a tariff, even if the businesses, because the sad thing is so many of our businesses have already taken major steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. As a nation, we've done a very good job at this, actually, better than many who are part of the Paris Peace Accord. But we don't get credit for it because it's not mandatory. We do it voluntarily. But I don't think that other countries are going to care, and that even the countries that have set aggressive targets will find there'll be a tariff on imported goods. That's a potential. Plus the fact that we lose our leadership, which is what excites the next level of innovation, seems at any level, and this is also sending a signal we don't really believe in science. Young minds that want to engage in this kind of thing and cutting-edge technology, the new things that bring new jobs, are going to go elsewhere. They're not going to stay here if they don't think science is deemed important and they don't think that basic research will be funded.
Do you think that's what comes next, that we lose on those accounts?
I think that's a real possibility. Maybe I'm overstating, but I think it is a real possibility. We already see, I know, in many of the companies that I've, or several companies with which I've been involved, the millennials, when they come in to do a job interview, one of the first things they ask is, what is your commitment to the environment? What are you doing on greenhouse gases? They care about this. And so I can see them saying, or conversely, we won't bring in some of the best minds that we have been bringing in to study here. And then they stay here, except when we throw them out, which we're now doing more and more. We're going to see them not want to come here because this is not going to be the place where that cutting edge research is being done. And we lose when that happens.
Does this mean the EPA will no longer regulate greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, I mean, I think we all knew that this was going to, that they weren't going to be very aggressive in their regulations anyway. Enforcement's being cut. President's budget proposal. Budgets to me were, as a governor, when I put budgets forward, EPA, when I put a budget forward, it was a policy duck. It's where you really think the issues lie and what you really want to address. And the way this administration's budget was proposed, with a 31% cut to the Environmental Protection Agency, that's kind of telling you they don't think much of it. And they're not going to be doing much. And the president said he loves the environment. He wants a clean, green environment. He was saying how well we've done. Well, we have. And if you think about it, between 1990 and 2008, we saw the population in this country grow by 30%. We saw our electricity demand, our energy demands increase by 35%. Our real GDP more than doubled. And yet we were able to reduce the 6 criteria pollutants by over 67%. So this idea that you cannot have a clean and green environment and a healthy, thriving economy is just wrong. That's the wrong way to keep posing these issues. And yet that's what he did in very strong terms.
So ultimately, what does this mean for the planet?
Well, the good news for the environment is, first of all, the rest of the world appears to be willing to continue to go forward. And we have a number of major companies that have set aggressive goals. We have states that have entered into compacts, the Western governors, Reggie in the Northeast. And we have a number of our major cities who have set goals for themselves. So they're going to continue to do that. They may just double down after the United States taking itself out. I just worry that we've created this void in international leadership on this issue, and it seems on several others. And that's going to not necessarily be filled by people who have our best interests at heart.
And that was my next question, is what does it mean for our global relationships?
Well, we're certainly straining them. Again, Trump scolded NATO for the countries for not spending what he thought they ought to spend. And he makes it sound as if there's actual a dollar figure they're supposed to put in. It's 2% of their overall budget. And really, the legal requirement is that you do that when there is a collective, or when one of the countries, the signatories, are in trouble.
Fareed Zakaria just said that the U.S., this move has made the U.S. no longer the leader of the free world.
Well, it certainly has reduced us. I mean, people aren't looking at us that way anymore. Russia is just loving this, and I think we are ceding that position. It seems that the president doesn't really care. He was talking about how people no longer laugh at it. I think that's just the opposite is happening. People that I have talked to overseas are just befuddled. They say, what is going on? What's happened with the United States? We need a strong United States. We rely on a strong United States. People need to understand that climate change is a national security issue for us. Because when you have these problems, see, we're an Arctic nation. When the Bering Sea opens up, you have Russian trawlers, Chinese trawlers. There are up there, and we don't have the presence to push back. We're not going to be at the table to negotiate things. I think we very definitely are ceding our leadership position. People aren't going to look to us in the same way that they did before. And when you think of what's happening in, for instance, in the sub-Sahara Africa, where you have very severe droughts, you have nomadic people who can no longer live off the land. They can't keep their herds alive. There's no water. They're moving into cities and towns that don't have jobs for them. Those are perfect recruiting areas for ISIL and Al-Qaeda. And we've got to understand all the ramifications for this, and it hits us in so many different ways. 200,000 Americans die every year because of dirty airborne issues, related issues. 200,000. So let's just talk about cleaning up our air, because guess what? Carbon is a pollutant. Mercury is a pollutant. What we're spewing out are not good for our health. asthma, childhood asthma, all the heart disease, lung cancer, emphysema, all those things are exacerbated by bad air quality. So let's just clean up the air, and that would help us with climate change.
Christine Todd Whitman, a member of President Trump's Republican Party, also head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency during the administration of President George W. Bush. Before that, she was governor of the state of New Jersey. She was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday, on the Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. United States has levied new sanctions against 9 companies and 3 individuals suspected of having connection to North Korea's missile program. The measures will block the individuals and companies, including 2 Russian firms, from doing business with U.S. nationals and will freeze any assets they hold in the United States. Meantime, the head of the U.S. Missile Defense Agency, Vice Admiral James Searing, says this week's successful test of the nation's ballistic missile defense system showed the U.S. can defend itself against the threat of launches from North Korea or Iran. He described the test as an incredible accomplishment and a critical milestone for what he called the ground-based mid-course defense system. Ricky Ellison heads the U.S.-based Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty the U.S. test was significant.
This was an historic test, the first time we actually tested and intercepted an ICBM missile with the same trajectory, the same distance, the same capability as the current North Korea capability is in the near future of North Korea. It is a tremendous achievement that happened yesterday.
Ricky, is this a foolproof defense?
It is a foolproof defense against the North Korean nuclear ICBM. Yes, it is. We will have 44 of these interceptors in the ground by the end of this year. We have, I think, 34 today. They cannot penetrate or go through that amount of capability that we have today.
Is this similar to what was called back in the 1980s the Star Wars defense that was promoted, promulgated by the Reagan administration?
It is not the same. There is no laser. There's no ability in space for intercept. This is still President Reagan's vision to be able to intercept and destroy a nuclear ICBM. This is the result of that. That was, I think, 24 years ago when that speech happened. And now we have a capability from that speech, but it's not a space-based weapon system.
Why has this system had mixed results in the past?
Well, because we rushed to deploy it in 2006 with 1990 technology that is way out of date in today's world. And we didn't invest in it the way we should have over the period of time. We took off the last 8 years basically to invest into a European missile defense system that we have in place today in Romania and Poland, and left investment and left leadership. And really, you know, the acquisition process was at fault. So we are getting ahead of that now. We've finally got that resolved. We're going to move to a brand new interceptor capability in 2021. But this should hold us off and handle that risk until 2021.
The U.S. military said it's going to follow up its experimental shootdown of the ICBM by firing 2 interceptors simultaneously at an incoming dummy warhead in a real-world test next year. What can you tell us about that?
That's the shot doctrine. We will never fire just one missile at one nuclear ICBM. We will fire 2. minimum. So that is going to show the exact what we would do in a real-world situation by firing two instead of just one.
That's Ricky Ellison, head of the U.S.-based Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization warn humanitarian crises are escalating in three African countries as well as Yemen. At a recent press briefing in Rome, the UN organization said the millions of people do not have enough food to eat, and children in particular are suffering. VOA's Kim Lewis speaks with reporter Josephine McKenna, who attended the press conference, and has details about what was said.
These two UN organizations, the World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization, are on the front line fighting what is a huge humanitarian crisis. And they wanted to hold this press conference to draw attention in particular to what's happening in Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen.
They also looked at Northeast Nigeria as a region of being of great concern. Why is that?
Well, they first of all said that 10 of the 13 biggest food crises in the world are about conflict. And one of the areas of particular concern is Northeast Nigeria. Denise Brown, who is in charge of the emergency response at the World Food Program, said the World Food Program was not prepared for the levels of human suffering that they are seeing in that area. The conflict has been going on for 4 years, as we know. Boko Haram is very active in that region. But she said this is a problem that was centered in Northeast Nigeria and, as we know, is now spilling over into other countries. So, as she said, this was the epicenter in Northeast Nigeria. But now that people are being displaced, it's becoming an enormous regional challenge as people are forced to flee their homes and this spills over into neighbouring countries. The World Food Programme estimates more than 5 million people are food insecure in Nigeria, not enough food on a daily basis. And Denise Brown from WFP said it's as if 2 million people are perched on the edge of a cliff. And it's not just about food, it's about health, sanitation, concern about some of the poorest people on the planet and how we're going to help them survive in the coming months.
Also, just touching briefly on Somalia, what did they say about lessons learned from back in 2010, 2011?
Well, as we know, Somalia had a severe famine in 2010, 2011. The UN agency said they perhaps declared the emergency, the famine, a little too late, in the sense that once it was declared, countries were reluctant to get involved. They were concerned about the Islamic militants. 250,000 people are estimated to have died. Now the UN agencies believe they need to be on the front foot. They need to be letting people know the state of these emergencies. And Somalia is another country that they're particularly concerned about at the moment. They estimate that 3.2 million people are what they call food insecure. They don't have enough to eat. And well, at least WFP, the agency that delivers food and handles the immediate response, is aiming to get to 3.5 million people in 2017 in Somalia alone.
Also, in looking at all of four countries, Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen, humanitarian agencies are now in emergency response mode. What do they say lies ahead for the future?
Well, there's great concern because the number of emergencies appears to be increasing, not only in Africa, but we still have the Syrian emergency in Syria and the number of people that are being forced to leave and immigrate to other countries. These agencies are really stretched financially, so they're looking for more contributions, donor aid from wealthy donors, corporate or government donors, and they're also looking for public donations. And another example that they gave is that 800,000 refugees have been forced to leave South Sudan and are now moving into Uganda. So that emergency is spilling over into neighbouring countries that can't necessarily cope with the scale of the crisis either.
That is reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome speaking with Kim Lewis, who hosts the VOA program Africa News Tonight. Well, it's time now to find out what's trending on social media with International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky.
Trending today, the ongoing effort to tackle hate speech online, starting with a report from the European Commission that shows a crackdown on hate speech by some of the world's largest social networks. It was about a year ago that the EU partnered with Facebook, Twitter, Google, and Microsoft to release a social media code of conduct, which included requirements like better monitoring of hate speech, removing hate content within 24 hours, and promoting training to recognize objectionable content and promote non-discrimination. Well, a year later, the European Commission says that those tech giants have made significant progress in combating hate speech, particularly in the last 6 months. They specifically cite improvements on how much hate speech is being discovered and addressed, and how quickly it's being removed. And among those companies, Facebook is the leader, reviewing nearly 60% of hate speech cases within 24 hours. And this is just the first step. The EU this week announced new legislation that will go further, requiring social networks to remove any videos that feature hate speech. That proposal is still being considered, but has already passed the first step in the process with approval from EU ministers. But there may be a limit as to how far social networks will go, and how much responsibility they want to shoulder. Germany's parliament is currently considering the Network Enforcement Act, a piece of legislation that, if approved, would hold social media liable if they fail to detect and delete objectionable content. And the punishment is steep, fines up to 50 million euros for a social network like Facebook. So Facebook is speaking out. They say the bill transfers responsibility for complex legal decisions from public authorities to private companies, adding that the people who post the content should be facing the legal ramifications, not the social networks. Now, what remains to be seen is whether this German legislation might impact how Facebook cooperates with the EU. For the time being, it looks like that relationship will continue, as long as Facebook doesn't have to shoulder the burden or pay any hefty fines.
International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky. Thank you, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. I'm on Twitter as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
People from around the world have enjoyed the unique hand-carved sandwiches at Manhattan's Katz Deli for over 100 years. And during World War II, the New York delicatessen began shipping food and salami to young men in the Army. Today, the renowned deli, always filled with thick stacked sandwich eaters, wants to try shipping their famous meats around the globe. Owner Jake Dell.
I think one of the biggest challenges is keeping the taste the same as it goes in transit.
The company still sends meats around the country, but figuring out a global distribution plan is still in the testing phase. Customers like Yaakov Sabak, who lives in Israel, thinks it's a good idea.
It's far away to mail some food to Israel, but if it comes to Israel and we have a station in Israel, yes, definitely.
Refrigeration for long-haul deliveries can be a challenge, but Dell says Canada is likely the first global stop, while South America has a strong passion for cured meats. From VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Nina Simone was an American singer, as well as songwriter, pianist, arranger, and activist in the civil rights movement. She employed a broad range of musical styles, including classical, jazz, blues, folk, R&B, gospel, pop. Well, Simone, born in 1933 in the U.S. state of North Carolina, died in 2003 in France, which was her adopted home. And this weekend, she'll be honored in a special tribute in Marseille. Here's a bit of Simone on the piano, highlighting her voice and style.
And now the end is near, and so I got to face the final curtain. Friends, I'll say it clear and state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full. I've traveled each and every highway and more.
much more than this. I did it my way.
Very nice. My Way, just one of hundreds of songs that Nina Simone put her personal touch all over. Hey, listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Patrick Dea, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday. Now, a bit more of Nina Simone.
Each trot of course, each careful footstep along the byway, yeah. Oh, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times I'm sure you knew when I bit off much more than I could chew. I threw it all. My fill, my share of losing. Now, as tears subside, I find it all so amusing to think I did all that, and may I say, not in a sly way. Oh, no, no, no. No, not me. I did it my way. Oh, what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has not to say the things he truly feels.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria has accelerated, said U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. In an interview with CBS News, Mr. Mattis said the U.S.-led anti-ISIS coalition has shifted from what he called attrition tactics, where ISIS terrorists are pushed from one position to another, to annihilation tactics, where the terrorists are surrounded and destroyed. Our intention is that the foreign fighters do not survive the fight to return home to North Africa, to Europe, to America, to Asia, to Africa, said Secretary Mattis. We are not going to allow them to do so. We are going to stop them there and take apart the caliphate. Secretary Mattis noted that while the tactics and the tempo of the anti-ISIS fight have shifted, there has not been a change in the rules of engagement. There is no relaxation of our intention to protect the innocent, he said. We do everything we can to protect the civilians. Defense Secretary Mattis said there is no question but that ISIS is going to go down. But he emphasized the fight involves more than just an army. It is also a fight about ideas. We have got to dry up their recruiting. We have to dry up their fundraising. The way we intend to do it is to humiliate them, to divorce them from any nation giving them protection and humiliating their message of hatred, of violence. Anyone who kills women and children is not devout, Secretary Mattis said. We're going to strip them of any kind of legitimacy. Secretary Mattis warned that while there is no question the coalition will shatter ISIS's sense of invincibility in their physical caliphate, we are going to watch for other organizations growing up. We are going to have to continue to keep the pressure on the enemy. There is no room for complacency on this. Complacency, no. Conviction, yes. Asked what keeps him awake at night, Secretary of Defense Mattis answered, "Nothing. I keep other people awake at night."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.